Good afternoon, everyone. It's lovely to have such a full house. My name is Anna Ambrose, and on behalf of Design Centre Chelsea Harbour, I'd like to wish you a very warm welcome to our Conversation in Design series. Before we begin, please can I just ask everyone to turn off their mobile phones? Thank you. So, to our much-anticipated conversation this afternoon, which has been hosted by House and Garden, I'm delighted to introduce the magazine editor, Hatta Bing, who is joined by our esteemed and much-loved guest this afternoon, Veer Grenny. Veer is the preeminent international decorator of his generation. His work has been featured in Vogue, Architectural Digest, and, of course, House and Garden, where he is listed under their 100 leading designers. Without further ado, please do give them a very warm welcome. Thank you.
Welcome, everybody. I'm delighted also to be speaking to... I'm delighted to be able to discuss decorating today with one of its masters, Veer Grenny. Veer has an instinctive and exacting eye, honed over 30 years of decorating houses. And fittingly, his book is published today, his first book, A Point of View. It's published by Rizzoli, and it's a very beautiful and informative book, exploring his life as a decorator, his influences, how he decorates, and providing a rich album of his work, some of which we will look at and discuss today. I'm sure you're all here because you know Veer's work well, but in my mind, his interiors are defined by an elegance and an order and a harmony, and they're always of the utmost in quality. There we go. But what's interesting, Veer, is while your rooms do tend to be highly, highly tailored, you have a strong sense, it's very important to you that they feel lived in. How do you achieve this? You're creating new rooms. How do you make them feel lived in?
Well, thank you, Hatta, for that, for your generous praise. It's very nice. And today is the day of my publication, which is quite appropriate. But funnily enough, the first image which has come up, normally my company just does domestic houses, and I think we're quite good at that. People that do show houses or more commercial work are very good, but I find that for us, we're better voiced at working for a client. But this first image, funny enough, is one of the very few forays we ever did into commercial work, and it was for a very important house in London, which sold very well, happily, for the investors. But to incorporate this feeling that it's lived in as opposed to being a show house, we always begin with books. I mean, books are everything. And it's so wonderful today, you can now buy them by the yard, but you're subject. So if you come to us and say, I love Chinese porcelain, there's people around now that can give you a whole library of it. And it's not unbelievably expensive. And I love different sort of books. I don't mean posh ones in leather spines or anything, but just a lovely eclectic feeling of books. You do that in any room and you're halfway there. It is absolutely extraordinary what a difference it makes. But this room I just want to illustrate because it's a library in a brand new house, no client, but it still has a great quality of looking lived in and developing a patina. Yeah. Now, the next thing which is really important to get into a room is layering. We talk about this in my office all the time, and it's not just this sofa, this wall, this whatever. It's the added things you add to it. Now, this particular room is a room of mine, which I've just done in a brand new house in Morocco. I built this house. So that room, although it could look 100 years old, is actually only finished 2 years ago. And all the walls are hand-painted. Now, I wouldn't advocate we all have to hand-paint every wall. But what I was really trying to illustrate in this is look at the layering, look at the funny rug on the floor, then there's another carpet on top of that, then there's books, and then there's all the hand-painted walls, and then there's a wonderful embroidery over the fireplace, and on the fireplace there's always bits of paraphernalia. So, and there's always flowers, always a plant, always those things. The only thing I will never have in any of my houses is white orchids, because I just feel they show a lack of imagination. I think it's just so lovely to have anything else but a white orchid. I know white orchids are good because they last a long time and la, la, la.
You can buy them in the supermarket.
But I just love any sort of plant. And I love, it can be the most modest thing in the world. It doesn't have to be smart. But I just love, and I think that room gives you an idea of patina, really, and how we develop it in the rooms that we decorate.
Yeah. And the books immediately bring a colour that you sort of don't have a control of, in a way, because you've chosen the book because you liked the book.
Yes, I mean, I think I even say in my book, I think every person that reads a Kindle, which I think is brilliant, by the way, should be forced to buy the same book so they can put it on a shelf, only because the spines of book is just so colourful, even when you don't have the spines of them. Yeah. And I think maybe it's that very quality hatter that gives... the feeling that people live in it and actually pull them out of the shelves and put them back again.
Yeah.
And, even move them around a bit.
Yes, exactly.
And I just think that gives a character so immediately. And we find so often when we're with clients, as soon as you put the books on bookshelves, they actually feel their whole life's been transformed. I mean, it's a very simple thing.
Yeah.
And there's probably not a room we ever design where there's not a bookcase in it for that very reason.
And then this is your own house.
And this is my own house. And as it happens, I lead a very busy life, probably like all of us, and I'm always going at it. But then I do always spend 2 days a week relaxing, and my relaxation is walking or reading. And this is my little library in London. It's a tiny room. It's got all the books, so that gives a patina, which you can see. Mm. But also the patina is there, too, with the carpet, which is a Moroccan carpet. It's also got wonderful damask fabric on the walls, courtesy of Tissus Helene, who printed it for me. But it's actually an imitation of a Fortuny. And so the room, again, has a layering and patina, and the plant as well. It happens to go onto a small terrace, which is rather nice. But I often think when you look at beautiful rooms or rooms that transport you, it's not necessarily about whether you like pink or blue or yellow or green or whatever. It's the accumulation of all the things in it which truly makes it beautiful.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably why in the old days people always reverted back to English country house taste, because it was a patina of things.
Yeah.
I don't particularly like that style anymore for myself, but I love the accumulation of things.
But it's easier done for yourself than
a client. Yes, much better. Thank you. Much easier.
But you manage for a client, and this is a room for a client, which absolutely has the feeling of layers and layers of things, doesn't it?
Well, this one here, again, it's a double room, really. It's when I met these clients who were wonderfully receptive people to work for. The room, it was a pine library, which was probably cost a lot of money. It was antique pine, but I found it incredibly depressing. So we ebonized it, and we made it into a dining room as well. And it is incredibly successful. It's successful also because I always feel that rooms that aren't used a lot never hold a vibration of people in them, and therefore that often... gives it a difficult feeling to live in. Whereas if a room like this isn't used as a dining room very often, like most of us, they don't formally have a dining room, it does convert into a wonderful dining room when you actually use it.
Yeah.
So, and again, it's got the books, but what is lovely with the books, which I love doing, is hanging paintings on the bookcase as well. So you see there's some lovely Dutch paintings and things all over the place as well.
Yeah. And were your clients, did they have art?
They did have them, thank goodness, and all the paintings in this room were in a different room. So as soon as I ebonized the walls and the bookcases, everything just shone out beautifully. Yeah. Whereas on pine, it's okay, but I mean the ebony gives it the dramatic
the punch,
effect.
Yeah.
And especially... for a London urban feeling, ebony is particularly good.
Yes,
it was a very
absolutely.
Good punchy feeling.
Yeah, exactly. And what you get from reading the book is actually how diverse in style and scope Veer's projects are, whether it be for different clients and in different countries. But there are definitely signatures, and I think one of them has to be fabric walling, that whether it's Morocco or London or America, we see it. What is it about fabric walling?
Well, it's very interesting. The next three images, which I'm going to show you, this is the first one. There's three images in this section. All of these rooms have fabric walling, and what's really interesting about it is it does many different things. First of all, acoustics is extraordinary. When you put fabric on a wall, the acoustics of a room changes dramatically. When I used to work years ago with Mary Fox Linton at Colfax, invariably when we did fabric walling, it was above a chair rail, which was a traditional way of usually doing it in the 18th century, and it was usually finished with a braid or something like that. Since then, I don't like chair rails unless I have to use them, and I love fabric walling floor to ceiling, and we never use it with a braid. We just finish it. It's called blind, so you never see any trace of fixing. So what you do is you walk into a room and it suddenly feels very very soothing or very hallowed, or your acoustics are very good. It's very nice for talking and conversation. So that's one of the reasons why we do it. And the other thing is, if you're using a dry cotton or using a velvet in this case or in the photograph before, you get the most amazing texture, because velvet goes in two directions. And if you're lucky enough to use silk velvet, it's even better, because it almost goes from silver to a very deep color. And it gives, I think, the most wonderful look to a room. Mm. So even before we hang the pictures, I find that we've got the atmosphere, and the client's excited anyway. So when you hang the pictures, that's even better. And they also, naturally, because it's almost like a three-dimensional thing when you use fabric, the paintings hang much, much better off it. So although it may appear and sound quite an expensive luxury, I think it pays off quite well, and it does take something out of the norm, that's what I think.
Absolutely. Which leads me on to colour palette. Actually, I think, is this room here, this is also fabric walling?
It happens.
So this is in Veer's old flat on the embankment, which had this lovely enfilade of rooms. And although each room was a different colour, actually I can show you a few images, it's a very subtle change between the rooms, and actually sometimes it's almost just the texture of whether it's paint or walling or fabric walling. When I think about your work, certainly a lot of the work that we've published in the magazine, there's definitely a sort of harmony of colours. Do you think I'm right in saying that?
Well, maybe. I mean, a very good friend of mine, Nicky Haslam, he always used to say to me, darling, what colour, what shade of white are you doing the next room? Which was quite interesting in a way, but the few photographs that I'm showing you now of my old apartment in Chelsea, they're all in shades of off-white or taupe or something like that. Yeah. There was many reasons for it, because it looked into the river and there was the most extraordinary view on the river. So somehow a strong colour didn't work. It was also 10 years ago, 12 years ago, when suddenly there was a fashion for not having too much colour. So but more importantly, 10 or 12 years ago, a lot of the people we were working for had pretty important contemporary art collections, and most of them imagined, which can be incorrect often, that you needed to have an off-white wall or a neutral colour to show the art off in the best way. I refute that often, and even if you go to the National Portrait Gallery now, you can see, in fact, that sometimes there are amazing colours on the wall, which they often paint just for a particular exhibition. So in these particular rooms, they all go from off-white to the palest blue to a beigey colour. And then this brings me to the next room that's on here, which is in fact a lovely indigo blue, the walls. And it's my bedroom in Tangier. And on the right-hand side is the view from the bedroom. So I actually chose the colour because it's almost just an extension of the room looking out into the Mediterranean.
So you're very much choosing the colours because it's what the room's sort of telling you.
Well, yes,
really.
I think, you know, like as I said, on the Chelsea embankment, the colours were actually quite neutral. A, it was fashion, and B, with the water, that literally the Thames was almost underneath me. The apartment looked directly into the Peace Pagoda. And the room, in fact, when you sat down, it looked like the river ran underneath the apartment. So the water was really in the apartment, which is very rare in London.
Yes.
And somehow with the reflection, the neutrals look best. And I would probably, if I had the apartment again today, I would probably do it in shades of neutral yet again.
Yes.
Although I love decorating with colour at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So moving on, this is a house, where you rented in Tangier.
Yes, this was... I always say that if you're... I have a client at the moment I'm working for who's a wonderful client and has amazing houses, but for a circumstance, if she's going to live in a rented flat for 2 years abroad, and it's quite a... The flat needs gutting as far as we're both concerned, but she's not going to. She's just going to put her things in it and live in it. And I said, well, the best way of doing that is at least paint the wall some colour, make it eclectic, make it fun, throw everything together. Mm. And I illustrated this here. This is a house I used to rent in Morocco that was almost falling down. It was, at least I had central heating to keep it warm in the winter. But I just painted all the walls different colours and threw everything at it. But it created the most wonderful atmosphere. Mm. When you work in interior design and you're used to things being very precisely dealt with, it's quite nice to be just entirely eclectic for a change, like I used to be in my young life, probably when you know everything I had to make do and mend wherever I was. But it gives the most wonderful atmosphere, I think, as those shows.
Yeah, it's very lovely. Mm. And now, so this is an example of a client with an important art collection, and. Yeah. But what I particularly wanted to ask about, because what I find always difficult, is choosing the whites that I'm going to use. And everybody seems to have different theories on what the ceiling should be, what the woodwork. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, first of all, this room is an extraordinary room, and there's about 20 different shades of off-white. But and the walls, in fact, are upholstered in white fabric. But... What we find in our office is invariably woodwork painted in grey-white is always the best. I loathe yellow-white unless it's for a particular reason. Yellow-white looks like top of the milk to me, which is about the most horrible colour in the world. And I always think it looks slightly grubby, whereas a grey-white makes everything look very clean. Now, I just think somehow living, especially in London or in a big city, all of us, you know, we just get... There's so much dirt around the place. I think when you go home, you want something calm, serene, and clean-looking. So grey-white on my woodwork, we always use a colour called slate, 1, 2, 3, 4, which...
And it's really quite grey sometimes.
Well, sometimes it can be very grey, but what's interesting enough, when I'm just doing the paint colour before I've fabriced the walls or painted the walls or wallpapered them, everyone comes and says, oh, my God, you can't use that colour. It's far too grey or it's far too dead-looking. But, in fact, it's the best complement.
Right.
And like everything in life, it's often the complementary thing which makes something worse.
Yeah.
It's not the initial essence of something that makes it work. So this room has got white walls but white fabric. All the woodwork is grey-white. The sofa and all the chairs are in different colours of silvers to whites. And it's really all about showing the Bridget Reilly's in black and white and in strong colour.
Yeah. And interestingly, you said that the that your ceiling is always...
Yes. Well, Hedra and I laugh about this because when I first started off, I remember someone once saying that John Farley used to put some pink in the white and blush the ceiling.
Which is what I was taught.
I was so impressed. I thought this is the most magical thing. I say to hell with it, don't worry, just paint it white. You'll find a good white ceiling never varies, you know.
So you don't even specify a type of white?
Never white. We have British Standard White.
Right.
You know, so...
Yes, which is makes it easy.
So often the girls will come to me often and say, what colour white? So I usually use my term and say, just British Standard White will do, you know, whatever they like. You know, I just find that sometimes we can become a bit too reverential about things, unless, of course, it's a very important ceiling in a great house and it needs overworking. Yeah. That's a different thing. But for most of the rooms we work on and most of the lives we lead, I think... just a good old British standard white will do. That's the only place it does work.
Yes, but the painters will be pleased.
Yes, so there's never any discussion about that.
So here you can see where you have used a grey skirting, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, I think what I wanted to illustrate in this picture here is, in fact, it's quite an interesting picture. It's photographed in a room, and the white part is a hall beyond it, although it looks like it's the same room. And in that hall, the walls are all panelled, and they're painted in, like I think, slate 3, and the skirtings are in slate 2, and the cornice is slate 1. There's many different shades of white, which in fact come into the room in the foreground. But in fact, the colour looks so different on the room in the foreground just by the tonality of what's above it, because in the foreground, it's done in this brown and white fucchini. And I'm just trying to prove, really, that the woodwork and skirting colour is all about the thing which is complementary to the main body of the work. Mm. Even if you're doing a room, just say you wanted a white room, I would do it in 3 or 4 different shades of white, of grey white, and that really helps the perspective of it. And I don't know, it just looks 100 times better. It really does, 100 times better.
And the thing about a more yellow-white is it goes yellower. It gets more and more yellow.
Yes,
so.
I think it must have been maybe in the 70s when I first started, or the early 80s with Mary Fox Linton. Mary always said, use a grey whites. Mm. And I didn't know what she meant. And most of the whites were sort of these yellowy whites.
Yeah.
And then when you put them against a grey white, they are really... They never complement it very well at all,
but
one imagines they would, but they
just
don't.
And this is in your house in London?
This is my house in London, as it happens, yes. So it's quite a good way of showing the different whites that we use with colour.
And so this is Vere's house in Suffolk, which you've probably seen pictures of before. Mm. It's been much photographed and seen on Instagram, I think, probably plenty of times, but it's very beautiful and it's called The Temple. But what I wanted to kind of ask you about, because in your book you write about the importance of a discordant note in a scheme, and your schemes are very tailored and ordered, and so how do you bring this discordant theme? What do you mean by the discordant?
Well, I suppose in a way it's a slightly cheeky remark saying it's discordant, but what the way I can best describe it, I suppose, is that in every room that we're doing for a client, and every time we're having a client meeting and we're looking at wall colours or the sort of floor we're going to put in, invariably it's wood if I can help it, then I never want to go on till the final solution, because once a room is being achieved and being worked on and we're installing it, it's only at that moment, if you're lucky enough, can we truly say what needs to happen to make it sing. I mean, you know, the only way I ever describe it, if a woman has a very well-cut black dress, if she puts nothing on it, it looks like a funeral, but if you put a lovely piece of jewellery, it looks like a party. You know, you can't really do it until the end. So in this particular case, and a friend of mine always says, Vere, you always have a touch of saffron yellow in a room. Sure enough, you see the whole room is in this wonderful pink and off-white, grey whites everywhere in pink. And then I always have this yellow cushion or the lovely shocking pink dahlias or whatever it may be. And in that room, I have 2 lovely alcoves. And every week, the people that help me in the garden, I can put in things like plumbago blue in it, or I can put in a yellow jasmine, or I can put in a tree lime or something like that. And that makes the room. The room without those few discordant notes looks lovely, but it never looks as magical as it does when you have them. And it's a really important issue to remember that one.
Because it creates a sort of tension, doesn't it, in a way?
Yes.
A sort of tension that you want.
Well, I think, you know, like music is all about tension. Everything that's really good, there is always a tension between 2 different things. And in this bedroom of mine, in fact, when I did it, I always wanted a white bedroom with a touch of saffron yellow, which I did. And when we were doing it, I always imagined the chair would have been white. But then, in fact, just as I was finishing it, there's hardly been a project in my life where I haven't used this fabric or a Fortuny fabric called Tupper in bitter chocolate. Both the fabrics have this bitter chocolate colour, which is the most amazing neutral. And there's never a colour it doesn't work. There's never anything it doesn't work with it. And just looking back over my work, there's hardly ever a time when there's not a touch of that sort of bitter chocolate colour. and it just works magic. If you think of any room you could imagine, it just works. It just makes it live.
Yeah, and it's a sort of grounding note as well.
I think,
really,
yes, maybe it's the earth. Maybe it's the grounding. Maybe that's why I also love dark floorboards in a room. I always think dark floorboards are a bit like the earth, you know, and then you put a rug on it, and then you work up.
Yeah.
Wall-to-wall carpeting's more difficult. Often we have to. That's fine. There's different ways. But I just think it's important, as Hatter noticed in my book, this discordant note, which just, as you say, gives attention and really makes it work. And I think it does work.
Yeah.
It's a lovely room.
Yeah.
And with a white chair, it would still be a lovely room. But I think the sort of pattern and the bitter chocolate makes it that much better.
Yeah. Also in this picture, you see the sort of balance. I think I remember you saying that the yellow jar or pot it's sort of, you put that in last when you suddenly you needed to continue the yellow and
balance. Yes, I mean, I'm not wearing my glass, so I can't see it from here, but I know over there on that lovely piece of Art Deco furniture, there was a wonderful little yellow glazed pot that was made by Giaponti, in fact, and it used to be in somewhere else in the house. And the day you put it there, it balances this saffron yellow in the room. It's a difficult room to live in too much.
Yes.
And this is another one which is very interesting. The room on the left is a drawing room we did, and it's in the most wonderful lilac-y pink. It's a very grand room, and it's got a lot of wonderful contemporary pictures in it. But on the left, you'll see a plant that I put in there when the clients moved in, and they always have that colour in the room. It's a wonderful lime leaf green. And the most perfect complementary colour to that pinky mauve is that lime leaf green. If you ever look at Art Deco, best of Art Deco, like at Claridge's, they always used to have that pinky mauvey colour and with lime leaf green. And so I love the two together. And on the other side, there's my living room in London, which has got these green velvet walls. But just showing there the piece of sculpture and the vase, it just shows, again, a colour which doesn't relate to anything, but just adds.
And hasn't been part of your original scheme.
Never,
when you
that
first
wasn't
were...
that just sort of something that then got passed over. But it makes that corner, because it holds the whole corner of the room together. Yeah. For a table that's really too low, it's somehow... it's all about balance and symmetry at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And I think it's the balance and the balance of tension which also gives a room a harmony, which becomes so attractive.
Yeah, absolutely. So going on to this, another, I suppose, signature is a writing desk. We always see, I think if you look carefully at any of Veer's projects, pretty much all of them will have a freestanding writing desk, isn't it?
Well, yes, we were talking, Hatter and I, really about, you know, furniture arrangements and how you furnish a room. But, I mean, I think if you anyone went over London today, one of the pieces of furniture you always see, which is never particularly overpriced, is a writing table. Mm. I love them because they're waist height. You always put something on them like flowers. It's always the right height. I love them when they come out from a room with chairs either side, because it's wonderful to sit and chat to someone. And if you want to chat about money or affairs of the heart, it's much better to be sitting upright than slouching in a sofa. So I think it's a very good place to have a very important discussion. And I think I will always try and put them in any room, a bedroom or a living room, wherever I can. I would always have a writing table. And I don't know, something about the shape. There's four legs. They can often be very elegant. And every great room, which I ever love, has always got a beautiful writing table.
Including this one at the back.
I think. Even this one here at the back. There is one by Genere, which is, you know, mid-30s industrial. You can't see it behind the chair very well. But again, it does the same thing. And in this case, which is really brilliant, it has underneath the sitting on the writing table, my client has a chess set where she plays chess with her son. And I love that. And again, it's a very nice pastime to do with somebody else.
Yeah.
But we were also talking, Hatter and I, about how to make a room comfortable. And this is one of the things that you make a room comfortable is the way the sofa's set. And if you look at that picture, you've got, you know, a sofa and two chairs. That gives you a group, an ottoman and some further chairs behind. So you've got room for quite a good group of people sitting together, either talking separately or together.
And it's the idea of having chairs that can move a little bit, so you can get you can always have chairs that are a bit that you can move to sit closer or further away. And
you'll see the chairs at the back, the black chairs, they're eminently movable, so you can move them closer to one of the chairs or move them closer to each other.
Yeah.
And David Hicks always did that, John Fowler did it, Nancy Lancaster did it. They always had a grand elbow chair which could be moved, so you can then create an intimacy, because the sofa and the big armchairs are slightly anchored. You can't move those.
Yeah.
And this shows a drawing room we did where the client wanted two distinctive areas. She didn't want to link them. So what is so very nice, you have a sofa and two chairs for one group, and then you have a sofa with an ottoman and two other chairs. You can't see the chairs at this end. But it gives two very distinctive groupings of people. And it works incredibly well.
Yes.
Incredibly well.
And you have strong views on kind of how far apart pieces are.
Yes, we have this. Yes. I now have a tape measure with me. I've discovered that 3 meters between you and someone else is, funny enough, still a very nice conversation. So if you have 3 meters apart, you can have two sofas. You can then also have an ottoman or something between them, so people can sit on the ottoman. If you had two people, you immediately create two different seating units.
Yeah.
And that's very, very handy. But if it's just two of you, 3 meters is fine to talk across.
Yes. Yeah.
And I find that really useful. And I think the next picture.
Yes, I think, unfortunately, we've got the old presentation. Do you want me to go back to it? I could probably.
If you could quickly go back to it.
Yeah.
It's really quite interesting, Hatta, because it shows this was a house I recently did for a young couple in Norfolk, this one here. And what I want to show here, the sofas are just about 3 meters apart, although the angle makes them look closer. You've got plenty of room either side. Often you'll have chairs at the far end as well as stools at this end, plus the ottoman. So often you can get 8 or 9 or even 10 people in a group together, which can be very nice. Not all the time. You mightn't want to all speak together. But at least it gives the flexibility. And when you have stools or you have an ottoman, you have the flexibility of moving intimately close together to for a conversation. And I think what often we lack today is people don't think the best way, because by my creating that grouping, it helps the conversation, probably helps my clients to, you know, have fun with their friends.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I think
I mean, that's the key.
That's our job. That's our job, is to help create the environment that will make people's lives work better.
Yes, and will make you feel pleased with your house if it all goes well and you have good parties.
And again, it's all about the balance of the colours of the furniture that goes together.
And this is actually interesting. It is in the country, and it's got fabric walling, hasn't it?
But that happens. That's in, this is a house in Norfolk, but it's got, the walls are covered in the most lovely, it's really a very, very pale blue-grey linen. It's not an expensive linen, but again, acoustically, the house feels very differently. I mean, I really would say to anybody, when you have a walled room, especially when it's not heavily decorated with braids, etc., it does have a completely different acoustic. And I just want to show this because there can be nothing surer that a fender around a fireplace is one of the best things to have in a drawing room, because I notice more and more that if you're entertaining people, you're usually perched on the fender and everybody else is sitting somewhere comfortable. And therefore, a perch space is really good for you when you're running in and out and everybody else can be sitting comfortably.
Yeah. So if you're me, once you sit on the fender, you can't move because it's warm and you don't want to move anywhere else.
maybe that's part of it as well.
But actually, in Veer's book, and he's already talked about it a little bit, but he has a whole chapter on his influences and the and you feel very influences of past decorators, which he references a lot, and. Veer, you feel that it's very important, the sort of knowledge of past decorating to your work.
Well, yes, I think in fact, Hatta, I'm sure everyone does it too, but the more you go on doing it, the more we all look for other people. And I don't think we ever copy anyone, but we continually imitate other people because they may have tried and tested something, and we know that's the best way of doing it. And in these two particular, one is Billy Baldwin's small apartment in New York, which was all about one-room living, and I put that in because he was probably one of the most influential people in my career. Not that I ever met him, but his work. And the room next to it, both have qualities of harmony, and both of them really talk to each other about the way the furniture sits with each other. Yeah. And in the next illustration, which we show here, this is probably my greatest influence besides Billy Baldwin, was always David Hicks. And again, it's difficult when you see those lime greens and those funny blues and those pinks all together. This was all for a different moment in history. Yeah. But I think all of the rooms themselves are incredibly pleasing. And again, it's always the way the furniture sits with each other that becomes a huge influence on me.
Yes.
And how we still decorate today. Like, for example, on the right, the four-poster bed.
Sorry.
I still copy that bed all the time. I mean, I copy the Pelham, it may change or whatever, but there's nothing more glamorous than a four-poster bed like that. You know, everybody loves it. It's wonderful in guest rooms because it's a bit like going on holiday. You know, people think how wonderful. Yep. So that was what I was really illustrating in that point from my book.
And actually, also, you shouldn't be afraid of kind of referencing decorators, because in the end, you only get better by honing your eye, really. That's mark of a good decorator.
Well, I think it's wonderful. The other day, I was, especially Instagram does this all the time. We actually see all of our work, or we see things we do being Instagram. And the other day, I looked at a book from a very good decorator, and it was like my room reproduced. And then I looked underneath, and it was Indy Hicks, and she very sweetly put, this is an homage to Via Greni. So I wrote back and said, well, look, I imitate your father every day of my life. So actually, it's quite nice, you know. So I'm always thrilled if someone imitates something I do. I don't mean imitate, but, you know, the influence is strong. I just take it as a huge compliment, you know. And I think we all should, you know, because nothing is sacred. It's all been done before.
No,
none
exactly.
of us are that important. So, but this room is one of the most important because it's Nancy Lancaster. It shows Chinese yellow. It just shows that profusion of comfort and joy and all the things you get in the most beautiful room in the world.
And you worked at Colfax.
And I worked at Colfax. So sadly, I never met Nancy Lancaster. But the older I get, I think, well, I'm not transgender yet. But I mean, I think I'm sort of imitating Nancy Lancaster every day. That, you know, with flowers that I always want in my house, and I want to have gardens where I can have all my flowers and everything else. The room on the left is one of the most ravishing rooms. It's one of John Fowler's last commissions, and it's both rooms, in fact, and it's a house called Cornbury. And I look at this, and I still think it's absolutely ravishing. The carpet in the 60s, it's like a cut pile carpet that you'd have today. Look at the way the furniture's arranged around the fireplace. There's a lovely writing table. Now, most of us, me included, don't have rooms like that to work on, but just the room layout itself, it can give nothing but pleasure.
Yeah.
And on the right, there's just one of my loves of all time is a fabric called seaweed, which is a Colfax fabric. And it shows he's pleated the walls in it, which is just so delicious and wonderful. I had to put that in just to show.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And so this is a house in Mustique that we featured a few years ago now. the client is a client that you've now done quite a few projects for, I think.
Yes.
What makes an ideal client to you? What makes what do you look for in a client?
what do we all look for in a client? All of us here, you know, long for X, Y, and Z. But the most important thing is trust. And the most important thing is someone that you have a rapport with. And this particular client and his wife are very good friends, and I've done many houses for them, and all of them are uniquely different. Every single one stands alone very differently. And they were one was incredibly grand. This is this particular client's present country house is very modest. You know, it's nothing about grandeur or anything else. It's just about having the faith to love beauty and do it differently. And this was a tiny little house of mystique that someone had built. The woman's husband was crippled, so she built this little bamboo, almost like a hut, on a cliff top next to Princess Margaret's house in Mustique, and had a funicular thing going down to the water so he could go into the water every day. And when my clients bought this house, and we made it 20 times bigger. And so we did everything in bamboo, all the guest rooms, everything in bamboo. And they're an ideal client because they said, why not? Let's just do it. And it's the most divine house in the world. I mean, it's just in the treetops, overlooking the sea, all bamboo. Just magical.
He's completely letting you have a
Swiss Family Robinson. And this is the other ideal client of all time. She's a woman who I've worked with for years. She was married to a very influential financier. They had one of the greatest art collections, and he only ever wanted white rooms to show off his art collection, which was fantastic. When they divorced, sadly, she said to me, Vera, please give me a room. I don't want any bloody art. I just love an amazing room. So we did the whole room in Bowood chintz, which I adore, with chintz curtains. And you see, there's no paintings. It's just some marvelous baguette wall lights that she had from her grandmother, pair of wonderful early mirrors. She had a wonderful commode, and I made another. So that's another ideal client. You know, she had the courage to say, I've had the best art in the world. Now I just want a room without any art in it. Yep. So let's do something mad. So she got it, you know, and I think it's the most heavenly room.
Yeah, and you'd never expect to see the Bowood in a room of that scale.
No. And it was a ballroom, this room. Yeah. It's in Sag Harbour in Long Island, and it was a ballroom of a very great house. Yeah. So it's an enormous room, but somehow the Bowood just looks perfect. And this is the other ideal client. Some people in Hampshire in Dorset built this wonderful, this brand new, this house, built this wonderful Palladian house. They were lovely clients, and that drawing room, the client's wife and myself virtually designed the room, even on paper. And that's a picture of it that I sketched. I didn't, but someone in my office sketched before the house was even built. Yep. So an ideal client in that respect, that we just went with it together, and receptive on every level. I think we all need to challenge the people we work with to a certain extent, maybe to be assured it's the correct decision. But I think after a while, when your rapport with someone is good, I don't think you should challenge. Mm. And I remember someone saying to me years and years ago that David Hicks, I think, said to me years ago, he said that, if you're a decorator and you're good, and he said, and if your clients meet someone else that's good or even better than you, if you're a nicer person, they're probably going to choose you. Because, in fact, if you're going to work with them for 2 years, you don't really want someone with bad breath and someone you don't like and you don't want to be with
personal.
For 2 years. And it's absolutely true, you know, that, in fact, when you work with people that you, I don't mean become your best friends, but you respect and like, the product is just so much better.
Yeah.
And this drawing is a classic example. Yeah. I mean, it's the most beautiful product.
Yeah, and it sort of, it really does sort of sing for
lovely.
It.
Lovely, really lovely.
So I think we're going to sort of end by looking at some of the pictures of Veer's latest project for himself, Gazebo in Tangier. But before we look at pictures, I just wanted to ask you, is there a big difference designing for yourself as opposed to a client?
I think we all have to have someone else to sound off. I work with someone in my... I have a lovely team of people that come and go, but the mainstay of my life is someone called Natasha, who is a director of my company, and there's not anything I don't discuss with Natasha, only because I need a sounding board. I'm not saying that I always say what she says, but you always need the other person to sound off. Now, therefore, even working for yourself, I bought a tiny little house and then made it a big house for some stupid reason. I decided... I just did. And so I needed a loggia to build. So a friend of mine had a lovely house in Dorset. So I just one weekend took all the measurements of those lovely arches that you can see, which were done by an English architect in the 30s, and I transposed it to the loggia I built in Morocco. You know, when you work for yourself, you always need the other person. But I think what you do what you don't usually do is spend lots of time pondering chalet or shanty. Yeah. When I do a guest room, I want a lovely big room with a four-poster bed and as comfortable as it can possibly be, and isn't that what my guest would like? What do I like for myself? I like a great big, beautiful, comfortable bed and, you know, da-da-da. So, and what when you work for yourself, this was the dining room, which is the only original room left in the house. It was a boring square room, so I thought, what the hell do you do with it? And then suddenly looked at Siri Morn's book and saw some plaster palm trees, and I thought, that'll do. So I put the did the plaster palm trees, did the room, and then I thought, now, when I'm about 120, I'll be able to afford to have some wonderful reverse glass paintings, Chinese 18th century. And then I thought, well, I'm not going to wait till I'm 120. And I was at a sale room, and there were 250 pieces of this divine porcelain, which was 18th century, in the exact colours I'd done the room. And I bought it, and you can make instant decisions like that, which makes something happen when it's for yourself. There was no client to ring, only my bank manager to ring to see if I could afford to buy the porcelain. That's all there was. Yeah. So your decisions had to become quite instant because...
And instinctive, I suppose.
Well, it's highly instinctive, and almost everything you do, every trick you do, you've done before. And therefore, like the fireplace in that room, I did that fireplace for a lovely suite of rooms I did in Claridge's, literally when I left Colfax.
Right.
But I took the fireplace at Claridge's from one of John Fowler's models. Mm. So I still had the drawing, so I gave it to Jam. They made it beautifully in China, sent it back. Now it's in my house in Tangier, and it's the most perfect fireplace. So when you work for yourself, you remember all the things you ever did and bring forward.
Yes.
And I'd never done plaster palm trees before, and never done plates over a wall, but I think it's hugely successful and I love it so much.
Yeah, and you had nobody to convince that they must do that.
Well, I mean, not many people you convince about it. Now, this is another thing I love because I'd done the Bowood room in Sag Harbour. I thought I want a chintz drawing room in Morocco. I mean, it seems the perfect place to have a chintz drawing room. But anyway, I did because I wanted to feel like a colonial house in, you know, somewhere else. And because if you look at English colonial architecture, I'm from New Zealand, so I am a colonial Englishman, if you like. They always had influences from their countries, but they always had an English influence as well. So if this had been in Nairobi, you know, in the 20s, you can imagine it, you know, with bits of African art. This has got a Moroccan embroideries, it's got Moroccan rugs, it's got...
you can see Moroccan bits of furniture.
Exactly. There's all sorts of Moroccan tables and furniture in the room.
Yeah.
And yet the walls are chintz, the most fantastic chintz I found from Lee Jofa that's hand-blocked. Mm. It took 6 months to print again in Thailand, and it's the most amazing, quirky thing. But I think everybody that comes to the room is spellbound by it. But and it's you look out of all the windows, one side there into the courtyard, and the other side on the Mediterranean.
Yeah, but it's totally unexpected and brilliant.
Well, for me, so I didn't have to convince a wife, a husband, and all their friends that chintz walls in Tangier was a very good idea.
No, exactly.
Only myself.
No, exactly. I mean, I think it's probably time for some questions, but thank you, Veer, for talking to us today and giving us a glimpse into your world and your work and how you decorate and talking through these glorious pictures of gazebo.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I think now there's going to be a book signing after this, so you can, if you... Oh, some questions first, exactly. Yeah, 5 minutes for questions.
Okay.
Have we got any questions?
Quick question. How do you deal with televisions?
Television.
In your rooms? Because I've not seen any TVs.
No, well,
I love TV.
I mean, the thing is, a television is a television is a television. Put the bloody thing wherever you like. I mean, we spend our entire lives worrying about things that come up out of lifts and God knows what. You know, in a funny way, the more, and Natasha and I were saying this the other day, the more we talk about it, look, if you want a television, that's fine. Just put it in the corner, wheel it out, whatever. You know, I have one in my little library in Tangier. As it happens, I never watch it there. But I have one in my little library in London, and I watch it. It's just the television sitting in the shelves like anything. I mean, in a funny way, it's a bit like saying, how do you deal with your your iPhone and social media. It's just there. You know, you can turn it off if you like, but somehow it's part of life. And what I don't like in decoration is trying to disguise things what they are. You know, it's my drawing room in 2018 obviously looks different to Nancy Lancaster's in 1956, you know, because you only had a wireless, you know. But I think, get on with it. I just, you know, I feel I'm so sick of trying to disguise things that aren't beautiful. I just think they're part of life. Yeah. And, you know, it's like having dogs. Dogs always, you know, I've got in all over Gazebo, I've got these lovely mats on the floor, which cost me a lot of money. And the dogs pee on them all the time. And it drives me insane. But in the funny sort of way, it's just part of life. You know, I mean, I prefer to have the dogs than the matting, you know. So, you know, I don't know. Yes. Isn't that how you deal with it?
I think so. Yes, and it can become very sort of cumbersome dealing
yes,
with
I think,
these things.
Yes, I think if we're not careful, we become reverential about things. Mm. I think that beauty in houses are absolutely vital. And one of them, I mean, I think nothing can be more beautiful, more lucky or wonderful than living in a beautiful house or having a lovely room to sleep in or whatever. But I think we must also take them and not be too reverential. And I think patina is also comes from having people and animals and
real life.
Real life going on in them. Yeah. Whereas a show flat that maybe, or a house that's done for spec, doesn't have that patina.
Yeah.
And it's all too new, and even the flowers don't look real enough.
Yeah.
They almost look too perfect. You want, you know, I just think it needs a bit of living in.
Yeah, just don't photograph the television for your book, because
it's not necessarily. sorry, that's how I deal with television. Maybe not the answer you want, but that's how I deal with them anyway. Yep.
I think there was a question over here.
Do you have a preference for paint making? Do you have a preference for the paint makers?
Paintings?
The people who make... Where do you buy your paint from?
Yeah. Oh, my paint. Well, I mean, sorry, I must be getting hard of hearing, I think. But there's a company in Ellison Street called Paint and Paper Library. We use them a lot, and also Papers and Paints in Park Walk. And, of course, what's interesting, too, because I've been in the business for a while, 20 years ago, there wasn't even Farrow & Ball, and we used to mix all our own paints. And now, virtually every paint you can get. So the Farrow & Ball, I don't think, is quite a good quality, but somewhere like Papers and Paints and Little Green and Paint and Paper Library, the quality of the paint is very, very good. And you'll usually find that your painter who's putting it on the wall will tell you if it's not good. Mm. And I think it's not false economy to buy a good paint. It might cost 20% more, but it's not false economy. You'll get the subtlety of colour. So that's what we do.
Okay. I just wanted to wrap up today and say thank you to Veer and Hatta. What an enlightening hour. I know we could go on. Veer, it has been an absolute joy exploring the success of your design aesthetic. Veer has given us a personal insight and perspective into how he creates immaculately tailored interiors, from describing his love of accumulation of things that make a room beautiful, his love of British standard white, I think everyone's noted that tip, who knew, discordant notes, touches of yellow, bitter chocolate, I could go on, but we are so appreciative, and Veer, your rooms are ones we want to be in. As Hatta said, we are going to be doing a book signing. Veer is launching his new book today, and I'm delighted he is going to be signing copies of the book. And also to celebrate his launch, we are offering some fizz and canapés at the back, so please do stick around. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.